Well, good morning, church. It is so good to be with you. My name is Kevin Sneed. I'm the lead pastor here at CPC, and we're glad to be gathering, albeit a little bit different this morning. Obviously, we're online, and we're celebrating this kind of odd Sunday between Christmas and New Year's together, but at home. And so this morning looks different, but I'm glad that we've gathered together this morning. Let me start by just saying, from my living room to yours, Merry Christmas. Now, I know that might seem strange. About a week ago, I'm guessing, you celebrated Christmas. You ripped open your presents, and you had all sorts of fun food and all of that going on, probably in a living room like this one, next to a tree similar to this one. But the reality is, Christmas actually isn't over. You know, historically, the church calendar, what's known as the liturgical calendar, has been a way of organizing different areas and seasons of the Christian life. And what's interesting about this time on the church calendar is we're actually in a season called Christmastide. And Christmastide is not just a day. For most of us, we're familiar with Christmas Day, but we race past Christmas. But what the church calendar actually teaches us is to slow down and not just celebrate Christmas in one day, but rather spend 12 days celebrating Christmas. You know, in my office right now, there's hanging this calendar, this sort of cyclical calendar that demonstrates the different seasons of the church calendar. Now, the church calendar is different from the sort of agrarian calendar that you and I kind of abide by, the sort of January through December calendar. And rather than kind of that calendar, the church calendar organizes time not based on months, but rather based around the different seasons of the Christian life. And so the church calendar actually begins with Advent, which about a month ago, you and I opened up, kind of had this beginning to the new church calendar year. And Advent is all about waiting. It's about preparation for the arrival in the incarnation of Jesus. It's about kind of longing and tapping into all of that waiting for Jesus to arrive. You know, we don't tend to think much about these calendar type things, but Advent, as it begins kind of the church calendar, actually awakens us to the very kind of story of Jesus. Because Advent rolls into what, again, you and I are celebrating now, Christmastide. And Christmastide is not, again, just a day to celebrate the arrival of Jesus, but it's, again, this season of 12 days from Christmas morning to January 5th. And I find it interesting that the church sets aside so much time to celebrate Christmas because, you know, you and I live in a culture that really isn't good at celebrating. We're pretty good at preparing. We're pretty good at kind of anticipating. But generally, we kind of get and arrive at a day like Christmas, and then we're ready to move on to the next one. We're ready to put away the decorations, take down the lights, put the tree back outside, and just kind of move on. And so for a few years, I've been really interested and kind of drawn into this idea of the church calendar because it teaches us to understand time differently. We as Christians actually encounter time differently. We organize our years and our weeks and our days differently. You know, one of the couple practices that you see this take place are is, you know, think about the way that like daily prayer or daily quiet time reorganizes the way that you spend a 24-hour period. You anchor yourself in the scriptures and communion with God in prayer. And that's how you begin your day. Think of the practice of Sabbath. Sabbath is a way in which we reorient the way we spend a week. We look at a week and we set aside one day as the sort of kind of anchor point of our relationship with the Lord throughout a week. Well, the church calendar, or what's known as the liturgical calendar, is another one of those practices that reorients how we spend a year. Joan Chittister, in her great book called The Liturgical Year, says this: "The way we define our years determines what we think our lives are meant to be about and how we live because of it. There are fiscal years and school years, planting periods and harvesting periods, calendar years and business years. There are years to mark every stage of life: childhood, adolescence, adulthood, middle age, and old age. And all of those periods are unlike the periods before it. The question is, what kind of year means the most to us spiritually? What in the spiritual life is there to enable us to live all the other years well, to their fullness, to the elastic limits of our growing souls?" You see, what Chittister's getting at is that Throughout history, the very way the church has organized its year actually gives shape to our own formation. And so for us, that again, that begins, as I mentioned earlier, in Advent. And Advent, the 4 weeks leading to Christmas, rolls into Christmastide, which is, again, a 12-day period where we celebrate the birth and the arrival of Jesus. Then that rolls into a season from January to mid-February called Ordinary Time, where it's just kind of the ordinariness of life. That gives way to Lent, which is the 40 days prior to Easter. And then, of course, we arrive at Easter, the great ceremony of the Christian faith, maybe the biggest of all the festivals for the Christian. And then Easter gives way to a long period of, again, ordinary time, where we're just going about our life awaiting that new year to begin in Advent. You see, this rhythm, when we pay attention to it, actually has a way of teaching us the very Christian story year over year, time after time. As these seasons and events kind of pass, and as we enter into them, walking through them, they help us to understand the Christian story and in some ways kind of get it into our very bones. Chitzer goes on a little later in her book and says this: the liturgical year is an adventure in bringing the Christian life to fullness, the heart to alert, and the soul to focus. It does not concern itself with the questions of how to make a living. It concerns itself with the questions of how to make a life. I really like that because, again, you and I can get so caught up in racing through the holidays, or as things begin to pick up speed, we're just going from one thing to the next. But the calendar, the church calendar, and particularly this season of Christmastide, teaches us to slow down, to be able to enter into something as mysterious as the birth and the arrival, the incarnation of Jesus. And that when we slow down, we actually allow that to sit in our bones a little bit more. See, I'm convinced that one of the reasons that 12 days is set aside for Christmas, which, by the way, is the origin of the song, The 12 Days of Christmas, that's where we get that title. That's where it begins, is this festival of Christmastide. And see, to me, as I began to explore the church calendar, one of the things that was fascinating to me is how did they, or why did they, set aside 12 days to celebrate Christmas? Last year I tried to do this with my family. I kind of pushed to leave the tree up and leave the lights up to see if we can make it till Epiphany on January 6th through the 12 days of Christmas. And I think we all gave up about 5 days into it. I don't know why, other than the fact that it seems like laborious to leave everything up. It seems odd. You're the last house on the street with lights still on your house. But the question that kept bugging me, or kept, you know, that I kept wondering, was how and why did the church leave 12 days? Why 12 days to celebrate Christmas? And what I kind of came to, at least this season, as I'm preparing or have walked through Advent and Christmas, is that there's something deeply mysterious about this event called the incarnation. There's something deeply mysterious about it, and yet I think there's wisdom in the church calendar teaching us to slow down, to not race past Christmas, but sit in that mystery. And so this morning, my hope is that we can just enter into that mystery a little bit more. I want to tell some of the Christmas story as a way of just kind of probing and maybe meditating on what does it mean that God became man? Because that is a profound mystery. You know, I've been using this word incarnation for a few minutes now, and that can be maybe something new to you. Maybe that's something that you're familiar with. But I want to kind of point to a familiar Christmas carol to help define that word, and I'll define it a little bit later. But consider the lyrics of that famous Christmas carol, Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Do you remember that line where it says, "Veiled in flesh, the Godhead see, hail the incarnate deity." I think that's a beautiful depiction of what we mean by incarnation. The opening line, veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. You see, at the incarnation in Christmas, we're celebrating this idea that God, the incarnate, or Godhead, the wholeness of God, Father, Son, and Spirit, is kind of made manifest or veiled in flesh. See, this is something, again, profoundly interesting. This is the kind of incarnate deity, this idea of incarnate. I used to have a professor who would say incarnation is kind of God con carne, which I think is probably a little bit like I don't know if it's problematic to say, but he would say it a lot. But it's this idea of God with flesh on. This is God with meat on the bones. And this idea that God would actually descend and become man, again, is something that we take for granted because we're familiar with the Christmas story, but we don't often consider the mystery of that. Listen to the way one thinker, Thomas Merton, once said. He said, "Christmas is not merely a day like every other. It is a day made holy and special by a sacred mystery. It is not merely another day in the weary round of time, but today, eternity enters into time, and time, sanctified, is caught up into eternity." See, Merton's point is that this day of Christmas, the incarnation, is deeply mysterious. It's when the eternal God who has always existed enters into time. And see, this mystery of God becoming human, of eternity entering into time, and time then being caught up in eternity, is one of the reasons that the church said we need to not just celebrate this for a day, but we need to spend 12 days in this sort of mystery of what all of this means for you and for me. To explore this more, I want to look at the way John's gospel unpacks this story. And so I want to look at John chapter 1. So if you have your Bible, flip there now. John, one of the gospel writers, begins and he tells the Christmas story maybe a bit different than the rest of the gospel writers. And he does this from a different angle, but let's read verses 1 through 5. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning, and through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The darkness shines in the dark, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." So John opens his gospel with this kind of famous prologue about what exactly the Christmas story is about. And he begins with this phrase, "in the beginning." Now, if you're a student of the Bible or have been around the scriptures at all, those three words should sound awfully familiar. It should point you all the way back to the beginning of the scriptures in Genesis, where the opening lines of the entire scriptures is "in the beginning." So why then does John choose these same three words to begin his gospel? See, I think he intentionally wants us to have in mind the beginning of all creation. And so there's something about John's gospel here when he says "in the beginning," where he's saying this story I'm about to tell you is about a sort of new creation breaking in right in the middle of this creation. It's a sort of new beginning, a start of something radically new. And so John chooses these words carefully because he's telling the story of an unfolding new world. And from the very first words of his gospel, he's pointing to the hope and the arrival that Jesus, this Christmas story, God in the flesh coming into humanity, is the beginning of a new world, but not somewhere else. It's right in the midst of this one. It's eternity entering into time here and now. And so John then goes on, he says, "In the beginning was the Word." Now, this idea of the Word is one that we have to unpack a little bit because we can be somewhat familiar with it, but there's a larger kind of narrative that John is telling here. You see, the Greek word for word is the word logos. And here it means word, that's a good translation of it, but it's much more the idea of kind of meaning or something that's embodying an idea. In the same way that words are that way, right? Our words, the language that we speak, are kind of placeholders for a larger understanding of meaning. And so John now is somehow equating Jesus with this concept of the Word. Now, it's hard for us to remember, but in the first century, the boundaries between different religions and philosophies and cultures, they were a little more fluid than they are today. Now, that isn't to say that all religions were the same in the first century. Absolutely not. That would not be an accurate statement. But rather, the concepts and the ideas were often in dialogue with one another. And so this concept of the logos, or the word, is really a much broader category that John is pointing to Jesus, saying Jesus is the true logos. See, this idea of logos, again, would have been very popular in sort of Greek philosophy and ancient philosophy and other religions. And it had this concept of kind of the sort of rational principle of the universe, the organizing thing that held reality together. And so John is saying, in the beginning was this word, this principle, this reality that held all things together. And he says, this word, what again he's putting as Jesus, which we'll see in verse 14 in a little bit, where he equates those two things. He's saying, in the beginning was the word. And then he says, and the word was with God, and the word was God. He was with God in the beginning, and through him all things were made that has been made. He's equating this concept of the word as something that has been around for always, forever and ever. It was with God, and here's the kicker, it is God. It was with God, and the word was God. See, here's where the mystery begins to kind of gain some layers and some edge to it, is this idea of the Logos, the word Jesus, has always existed with God. It is one of the three persons of the Godhead: God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. You see, and John is drawing these concepts together that the word Jesus has been pre-existent with God. It's always been there. And then notice as the story progresses, it says, in him, that's the word, the Logos, in him was life. And that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. You see, the crux of sort of this paradox of understanding who God is comes down to this metaphor of light. And it's Jesus, the Word, who pre-existed, always been around, is the sort of embodiment of life itself. And so this life is kind of bursting into the world. Remember, in the beginning, when Jesus arrives in the flesh, there's this whole new world, this whole new life that's breaking out into creation. See, and I think here's the reason this is important, and the reason that John spends this kind of creative time thinking through this idea. It's because this is, if the Word, Jesus, is God, he isn't just speaking on behalf of God, he's the very expression of God. Which means if you want to know the very essence and character of God, you and I don't need to look any further than Jesus himself. Jesus is the fullest revelation, the fullest expression of who God is. And this, again, is a profound mystery. So the question, though, is if the Word was pre-existent with God of all time, then what exactly are we celebrating in Christmas? It still doesn't necessarily answer that question of why we need 12 days to kind of sit in this mystery of, okay, I can get the idea that Jesus has always been with God, but then what is it that we are celebrating on Christmas? Well, look down at verse 14. It says this, and after a little bit of a few verses where he talks about John the Baptist and this other kind of dialogue about someone pointing to Jesus, we get to verse 14 where we see this word Logos again for the first time. It says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. See, here's where we get the crux of John's Christmas story. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. See, the Word became flesh. There's two things that we have to unpack here. This idea of the Word becoming flesh, and secondly, that it made his dwelling among us. See, first, the Word became flesh. Now, this is the Greek word that, if you remember from our fasting series a little while ago, was the word sarx, which meant, again, flesh. However, in Paul's usage, it had this connotation of kind of the fallenness of humanity. And I remember in that series, I mentioned that it's not always that context, because here's another one. Here, when John uses the word flesh, he doesn't mean our fallen nature. He means quite literally the flesh, the meat, the bones, the things that create a human being. And so when John says that the Word became flesh, he's saying the Word, the divine reality of God, has become the very fullest human that it is. The Word became flesh. God became human. Again, this is a profound kind of mystery. It really is a sort of stunning paradox that When you try to understand the idea of God being fully divine and fully human, both in the same being, it gets difficult to really wrap our heads around. But all I want you to catch is this. In Christmas, we are not celebrating the creation of Jesus. Jesus was pre-existent. He was the Word there before all time. What we're celebrating is, again, the incarnation, the arrival of God in the flesh. This is something utterly different. This means that when the Word became flesh, the very transcendent God, who's above all and stronger, more powerful than anything, became as finite and as imminent as a human. But this Word became flesh, and then what does John say it did? It made his dwelling among us. Now, this is a fascinating phrase, because this Word made his dwelling, or dwelt among us, is the exact same word that the Greek writers would use for the word tabernacle. Now, what is the tabernacle? The tabernacle, if you remember from the Old Testament, was that tent or that kind of gathering place they'd carry around wherever they went, wherever they traveled through the ancient world. And when they set up camp, they'd set up the tabernacle, because the tabernacle was similar to like the synagogue, the church building, if you will. It was the meeting place where the people of God would meet with God. It was, kind of theologically speaking, the overlap of heaven and earth. It was, if you wanted to meet with the presence of God in the Old Testament, you would go to the tabernacle. This is profound, because what John is saying is that the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. Meaning that if you and I want to meet with God, we have to go no further than the very person of Jesus. In fact, some translations will actually say the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. Again, this is deeply kind of mysterious, because this is something that for the Old Testament, the old kind of Israelites, they would have been this profound confusion. Like, you can just go to a person opposed to a place. But there's some sort of beautiful mystery in that, that if we want to encounter God, we simply go to Jesus. See, Christmas is the opportunity that we enter into this Word becoming flesh and tabernacling among us. This sort of mystery of God the infinite, God the transcendent, is also God the imminent, God the close, God the near. See, this is, again, something that begins to sort of confound our kind of categories. We have a hard time placing God in these small, finite areas. And so to close, I just want to kind of point out, and things I've pointed out along the way already, three mysteries of the incarnation that I think are worth us slowing down and paying attention to this Christmas time. The first is this, that the mystery of the incarnation reveals the paradox of God. See, it's hard for us to wrap our head around this, but the first mystery is that God truly did become human. Again, we say this so regularly, but we never really stop to consider that God, infinite in being, became finite in being. See, we have this sort of bias that we kind of, as in the modern Western world, we sort of arrogantly believe that we can just understand everything. We come with a clean slate and we have the capacity within us to really understand these sorts of things. But again, I think it'd be remiss to not pause in a season like Christmas and to consider that maybe this is something beyond our comprehension. It is, in fact, a paradox. God being fully human and fully divine. I'm reminded of Paul in Philippians when he writes in chapter 2 of that letter that Christ Jesus, who being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage, but rather he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. See, the mystery, the paradox of the incarnation is that when God became human, he subjected himself to the fullest of the human experience. And Paul says that Jesus did not consider that divinity something to be grasped, but rather set it aside, even to the point where he would walk through the experience of death. See, again, this is what's so profound about the paradox, this sort of incarnation, is when we get to Lent, When we get to Good Friday, we recognize Jesus as walking the most human of paths, walking through death itself. But of course, we know that Easter's coming. But that paradox, we shouldn't rush past. Paul's kind of beautiful poetic expression of who Jesus is a stunning picture of what the divine is. So the first mystery, again, is that the incarnation reveals the paradox of God. Secondly, the mystery of the incarnation reveals the character of God. Again, kind of it builds off of that first mystery, but here's what's so interesting is if God, setting aside that divinity, steps into humanity, that changes what we understand about the character of God. See, the Christmas story reveals that kind of most clearly this character of God in the fact that Jesus was born in obscurity, he was born in poverty, and he was born in vulnerability. Right? Consider the story that you know so well. First, he's born in obscurity, right? The Christmas story is one where an angel reveals to Mary that she was going to give birth to this Jesus, the Messiah. Really, Mary and Joseph were in this kind of corner of the Roman Empire. They're stuck kind of under oppression, and they take this long journey to Bethlehem where they're trying to just evade and kind of keep their life together. And I'm imagining as they're sitting in that manger, as Mary felt the sort of bitterness of I'd imagine, a significant loneliness. And the labor pains began to set in, and maybe it was Joseph and possibly a midwife, but the reality is Mary, Joseph, and the very Son of God were alone. They were born into obscurity. It's not the way we would understand a king, a God, showing up on the scene. We would expect much more pomp, much more circumstance, much more kind of elaborateness to the story, but here we understand the very character of God as one that works in the obscure things, works in the small things. Jesus was born in utter obscurity. Secondly, he's born in poverty, right? Remember, it wasn't that as the story progresses, God reveals to who? The shepherds of Jesus' birth, that the shepherds come. Now, the shepherds were not a kind of elite role in society. If anything, they were ones that would have been lowly, kind of disregarded in the world, but it's these shepherds that God chooses to reveal the birth of Jesus to. And it's something in them that you see the shepherds, they hear of Jesus' birth, they act in response to that news, they go to see Jesus, and then they praise and tell others about it. See, there's something about the poverty of the shepherds where they recognize Jesus and Mary, this sort of poverty of kind of akin to fellow strugglers in poverty. There's something about this, that Jesus was born in humble poverty. And then lastly, you see Jesus born into a situation of great vulnerability. Do you remember that at the time of Jesus' birth, there was immense turmoil going on in the first century? It isn't just that Jesus was poor, but rather that he was on the run from King Herod. And Herod had kind of gone to these great extents to extinguish any threat to his power and his authority. And so Mary and Joseph were kind of running out of town for their life. It was a scene of vulnerability that Jesus was born into. Obscurity, poverty, and vulnerability. These are not the characteristics that you and I would assume about God. There's something mysterious about this. You see, it should be no shock to us that throughout the first century, as Jesus came into his own, as he began to make these claims that he is the Messiah, the Son of God, you know, everyone in the first century was looking to him and saying what you and I say. That's not the way God looks. That's not the way God lives. And people would get upset with Jesus because he would do things that shocked their understanding of who God was. See, I hope that you and I do not succumb to that sort of naivete to think that we have the correct view of God, but rather, my hope is we come with a humility to say that the incarnation of the Word becoming flesh shocks our understanding of God. That we enter into that mystery to say, there's something about the character of God that we're learning new. This is not what we anticipate in the way that God would arrive. So again, if the mystery of the incarnation reveals the paradox of God, the mystery of the incarnation reveals the character of God, and lastly, the mystery of the incarnation is the overlap of heaven and earth. The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. See, this mystery of heaven and earth overlapping in the person of Jesus is so profound and so mysterious that words kind of begin to fall apart as we consider it. But the reality is this, is that this new world being birthed right here in the midst of this one is one in which we can enter the reality of heaven here and now. The person of Jesus is that sort of overlap of heaven and earth. There's a sort of hope that pulses through this story, because what Mary and Joseph long for, what you and I long for, is for the world to be put back to rights. We pray, as Jesus instructed us, for his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven, because we long for this overlap. And right now we live in the kind of time between that fully happening, where Jesus has arrived, but he has not returned again a second time to establish that kingdom kind of in its fullest expression. But the fact is, the incarnation is the beginning of that. We see a foretaste of heaven and earth overlapping. And you and I can step in to that reality here and now. You see, this story of the incarnation, this mystery of what it means for the Word to become flesh, is one that I pray you and I don't rush past. My hope is that this Christmas season, that maybe even if all your decorations are already in boxes and tucked away in the attic, I hope that you still carve out a little bit of time to consider this mystery of what it means for you and me that Jesus, God, the God-man, became flesh, entered into our story. My invitation is that maybe if you would, you'd just hesitate from rushing past Christmas. We'll have time to get back to the ordinary days of our life. We'll have time for that, and soon it will be Lent and Easter, and we'll get to all that. But for now, I invite you to enter into Christmastide, a season to slow down, to consider the mystery of the incarnation again. To close, I just want to quote the poet Mary Oliver. She wrote this small kind of poem about the instructions for living a life. And I think this short poem is really worth you and I adhering to as we kind of come towards or through the season of Christmastide. And here's her short poem, her short instructions for living a life. Pay attention, be astonished, and tell about it. Merry Christmas, church.